I did not finish in the last lecture all that I had planned to say about spirits who come to obsess the living, or who live with them and share their mana, and are like a subconscious. They stay in the background and push forward an emotional urge as a rule, or thoughts of various kinds that act as compulsions. These eating companions, they eat the mana and share the life with a person, give the little mental nudges, and sometimes cause emotional storms and different types of trouble. They appear sometimes at birth or very shortly after that. Sometimes after a shock, they are able to get a toehold and hang on, and are active with or within or with a person as some unseen entity. The New Orleans group in the report said that they like to have a few more stories, that the lecture was a little bit dry, or at least that is what the lady said who reported on the general conversation. Let me tell you a story here of the strangest personality of all that I have heard of that appeared. I want to read the little sketches from page 111 on in my book, The Secret Science Behind Miracles. This was a story that was vouched for and told about by Dr. Lee Apsley. He was a brilliant research man, very highly educated, and he was a lecturer in Honolulu, supported by the local people in his travels to get material, and then to share that material with the people belonging to the group and with outsiders. He was a biologist and was very well posted on all psychic matters. The story that he told of investigating and treating was that of a young lady, 28 years of age at that time, and the daughter of a prominent California attorney. From the age of four, this young lady had alternated personalities regularly every 4 years. Only two personalities were involved, and there was complete reciprocal amnesia. That is, when one girl was in charge of the body, the other girl did not remember what had been done during the stay of her companion. The change of personalities, which came with such regularity, would be made in a moment of deep sleep. The secondary personality had been a baby when it first arrived, but it had learned very rapidly and soon equaled the mental growth of the primary personality. Through the years, each of the two personalities had continued its growth and education in its times of dominance, and each was able to learn with amazing rapidity anything that the other one had learned before it. Neither had the slightest memory of the experiences of the other. Upon returning to the body, neither personality could remember what it had done, where it had been, or where had it been while away. There was always surprise and momentary bewilderment at the time of returning to a body grown 4 years older and unfamiliarly dressed. The primary personality was quiet and studious. It loved to sew and was shy and retiring. The secondary personality was an aggressive and unabashed tomboy. Their tastes and recreations were very different. One of the changes took place one afternoon while the mother was reading to her 12-year-old daughter. They were in the sitting room, and the primary personality, whom we may call Miss First, was then dominant. The child was listening quietly and happily to the reading when she suddenly fell asleep. It was Miss Second who wakened in the body a moment later. 4 years passed. Miss Second, now 16, was in the same room with her mother. The mother was reading from another book, but this time not aloud, as Miss Second did not care for books. The body fell asleep, as it happened, in the same big chair in which it had been sitting 4 years before, and on much the same kind of a sunny afternoon. Suddenly the eyes opened, and Miss First looked wonderingly out. "Why did you stop reading, Mother?" she asked. She was unaware that 4 years had passed. She thought that she had just dropped off to sleep, and that the reading of 4 years before had suddenly stopped. When told what her experience had been and what had happened, she knew by remembering similar occasions what must have occurred. Also, she could see that her body was larger and that it wore a dress much too colorful to suit her quiet taste. So, every 4 years, the girls changed places in the body. At the age of 28 or nearing it, each girl had lived 14 years in the body. With each change, the wardrobe had to be made over to suit the personality who took over the body. Amusements were instantly changed, as well as diets, habits, and occupational hobbies. At last, the parents decided to call in experts to see if there was some way in which the secondary personality could be forced to leave the body to the primary. In this, the parents were much perturbed, as they had come to love both personalities as much as they would two different daughters, as indeed the girls seemed to have become to them. The investigators took the young lady and explained to her that they were going to hypnotize her and endeavor either to cause both personalities to blend into one or to get Miss Second to leave the body entirely to the use of Miss First, who at that moment had possession, but feared the approach of the usual time of the change. Most eagerly, Miss First submitted to the treatment. Under hypnosis, the usual thing occurred. Both personalities appeared in turn and could be questioned. Each personality showed a complete memory of its own periods of life in that body, and each said that it knew all about the activities of the other, not by sharing those experiences, but by reading what was in the memory of the other. They were not sure whether they stayed in the body or not when they were latent, and they showed the usual lack of reasoning power. When the subconscious of Miss Second was told that she must go away and leave the body, the reply was vague and unsatisfactory. The order seemed to be accepted, but the doctors were convinced that nothing would come of such a command. So convinced were they that they also gave the usual hypnotic suggestion aimed at forcing a blend of the two personalities. And we must note that as the subconscious alone can be hypnotized and made to act upon given suggestions, the blending must be between two subconscious entities. Such a blend would give the dominant conscious entity, the middle self, a double set of memories and so initiate a completely blended pair of personalities. It would seem quite impossible, if the kahunas are right in their postulations, that two conscious selves could blend without becoming instantly aware of their duality. After the first treatment, it was found that no blending of personalities had resulted. The treatments were continued daily until the usual time for the change of personalities drew near. It was hoped that Miss First, well aware of the fact that they desired her to stay in the body and blend consciously and subconsciously with Miss Second, would accomplish something. However, when the change occurred, Miss First was not blended with Miss Second. Hypnosis was again applied after the new arrival had heard what was being done. Again, the subconscious minds were questioned. Miss First remembered the instructions given to her to try to blend with Miss Second, but said she was unable to do anything about it. And when asked where she was now, she answered only, "Here." Suggestion was next tried to attempt to drive Miss Second out of the body. And then a startling thing happened. The body became as if dead. No response from either subconscious could be obtained. The doctors and the parents became much alarmed. It was their desire to be rid of the invading personality, but now it seemed that they had driven it out but could not recall Miss First. While suggestion was being laboriously continued, a still more startling thing happened. The lips opened and an entirely unfamiliar personality spoke to them with such wisdom and authority that they were confounded. The new personality spoke with a resounding voice which had in it an evasive but undeniably masculine quality. It was much like the gentle but very firm voice of an old man. The group about the girl's body listened in amazement. Immediately the doctors realized that they were hearing still another personality addressing them. To add to their confusion, they realized that this new personality did not seem to think as they thought. It seemed not to be logical, but superlogical. It seemed to know definitely and to the smallest detail what had gone before and what was being attempted. It asked no questions, but began at once to give one statement after another concerning the girl and her and their lives, the girls and their lives. Each statement was precise and covered ground with which the parents and the doctors were familiar. As soon as the new personality had summed up the conditions, it became silent. The doctors asked who the speaker might be. The answer was still another statement, and it was to the effect that this personality was one which had the two girls and the one body under its care and guardianship. In answer to more questions, more facts were stated, always without argument, such as a conscious mind might use, and always without explaining reasons. The group was told that the two girls were using one body for the purpose of living and experience. The doctors then contrived their best arguments. They told in full the way in which the change of personalities was ruining the life of the girl. She could not marry, she could not live a normal life, and to this the new personality answered with statements, the logic of which seemed without argument and without reason. Statements followed the statement, each giving some definite purpose of living, the various purposes of growth and experience. The learned doctors were helpless. Each statement was so profound and perfectly reasonable that they could find no logical argument to advance against it. They were like children confronted by age-old wisdom. The type of thinking with which they were confronted was not human. The doctors could have been able to produce arguments in favor of the statements which were given, but they could not have given arguments against them. In a very short time, they lapsed into silence. The personality which addressed them had left them helpless. In desperation, one of the doctors cried out, "If Miss First is not allowed to have the body, we will keep it hypnotized indefinitely." To this, the answer was another statement, to the effect that no one would do anything to injure the body. Still another statement was given, the final one that closed the interview forever. This statement was simple and to the point. "If you interfere with my work, I shall withdraw the girls and leave you with the corpse." There was a long silence. No one in the group doubted for an instant that the wise old personality would not fulfill its threat. There had been a conviction of truth and serenity of power in every word. At last someone ventured to ask another question, but no answer came. More time passed. Then suggestion was made to release the body from hypnosis. Miss Second opened her eyes and smiled. The doctors and parents gave up. They had been confronted as if by God himself. They realized the futility of their efforts. It is difficult to find any instance in which the high self has spoken to a person through the low self in words. This comes the nearest to a condition of that kind of anything that we have had so far. Outside of very fine mental pictures which the subconscious seemed to have given in various cases to guide the people who were asking for this guidance, to have the high self speak in words, this is the only case, as I have said, of which I know. Most of you have by now heard the very fine lecture by Isabel Hickey, Huna Research Associate of the Boston group, a long time group of her own, and not particularly associated with Huna. You've heard in that lecture her story of rescue circles in which the people who have been earthbound, the spirits, not particularly bad, but people who were caught before they could get across and were not able to cross over and get away from their earthbound condition. There are good spirits that helped through mediums as a rule, and the rescue circles, such as were described by Isabel Hickey in her lecture, are carried on in spiritualistic churches all over the country, and they are labors of love. They do a great work helping to rescue people from these various circles. Nandor Fodor, in his big Encyclopedia of Psychic Science, writes under the heading of evil spirits. According to spiritualistic philosophy, they do exist. There are many intelligent entities in the higher and lower spheres which may not be of human origin or may not be benevolent. But the evil spirits commonly spoken of are the spirits of bad men who inhabit the lower spheres, from which, either owing to the special locality in which they are earthbound or the attraction of bad, immoral sitters in a seance, they may easily reach the medium. Their appearance may be accidental also. They may see the light or the emanation of the medium and attempt to oust the good controls, the spirit controls, he means. The controls, as a rule, are able to keep the evil spirits away, but sometimes, for unknown reasons, their power fails. In such cases, they are urgently asked for the breaking of the circle and the suspending of the sittings. The guides' spirits very often are able to drive the invaders out of the medium. Sometimes the leader of the circle will make the sign of the cross in the air and project it against the invaders, and sometimes even the sign of the cross will be marked on the chest and then on the back of the medium. The spirits very often respond to this. To say, we have very little in the biometric readings to show that a spirit is there unless we ask the low self to give us a reading if there is a spirit. And it will first show by the swing of the pendulum that there is a spirit there. Then it will give us a reading to show whether it is a good spirit, whether it is a normal spirit that has a low self and a middle self, and perhaps if it has its contact with its high self. Then its intelligence can be measured and given in terms of degrees, just like that of a living person. And these good spirits are very valuable. Not only mediums have them, but many of us have guardian angels of which we are not aware. They give us good impulses, good hunches, but they never force those things upon us. They help us, but do not hinder. The business of exorcism to get rid of these eating companions and spirits is a very interesting topic. The kahunas used to accumulate a very large charge of vital force and use that as a mesmeric shock to drive spirits out, and then to use the hypnotic command to tell them to go away. And also the kahunas were spiritualists. They had mediums working with the healers very often, and they would get good spirits to take the dislodged bad spirits and police them up. They would take care of them, jail them, I suppose, in a spirit way. But that was their method. In the churches for centuries, ever since the driving out of the devils in early Christianity, we've had exorcism. The priests of the churches had certain rituals, and they would call upon holy names and use magnetized holy water to sprinkle over the person, and sometimes they could dislodge these entities, but the success of such exorcism was not so great that it has had any great popularity in the past or even today. It was a last resort business. When I was in London in 1925, I had an interesting experience. I'll tell you a little story about that. I heard of a gentleman who was an exorcist, but what he did was to drive spirits out of haunted houses and haunted palaces and haunted places of all kinds. I made a date and went down to see him, and he was Father John. He was an Episcopalian minister or priest who had left the active service of the church, and he lived down in Leicester Square, which was a very squalid part of London. And he helped the poor, the downtrodden, the underprivileged. He lived very, very frugally. And in order to make money enough to continue his work and to live and to help the downtrodden, he would make long trips and charge heavily for them to different parts of Europe. And he would exorcise old castles, old palaces, old houses where they had ghosts that would make noises like dragging chains up and down the stairs, ghosts that would slam doors, ghosts that would do all kinds of poltergeist activities and make it impossible for the owners or their friends to live in these places. He was very successful with that, and he used a combination of powerful hypnosis and other church ritual. And he said almost any spirit was afraid of the holy things of the church. And if it could be made clear to them that those things were about to get after them, they would leave. He was on his way when I met him to a place in Italy where he'd been called. A big castle there was badly haunted. And I asked him, I said, "Will you drop me a line?" I gave him my address. And let me know later on how you get along with this. It was quite an interesting story of very strenuous ghostly activities. And about 6 months later, when I was back in Hawaii, I had a short letter from him telling me that his report on the place had been right in the first place, that the spirits had made all the trouble that had been described, but that he had managed to lay them all. I think there were several of them that had been exorcised, and that they had not come back after a period of several weeks, so that he was satisfied that they were gone for good. A more modern exorcism was practiced by Dr. Wickland in Los Angeles a number of years ago. The good doctor has passed on now. His wife was a very fine medium, and the doctor would work with people who had smaller obsessions. Not the completely insane, but those that had dual personalities and had spirits bothering them in various ways. He rigged up a big shocking machine. It was made to develop static electricity, and when he would throw a charge of the electricity into the patient, it would hurt quite considerably, but not injure the body. And it hurt the invading spirit worse than it did the person who was in the body, and they would move out. The mediumistic wife, with her good spirit guide, would watch and immediately invite the spirit, when it was ousted from its home, to come on into her home, into her body, and have a place to rest. The spirit almost always accepted the invitation, and once there, they were more or less under the power of the other spirit and of the medium and of the good doctor, who would explain to them how bad they were, how they should behave themselves, how they should go with the good spirits that were around them and continue life on the other side, learn the lessons that the good spirits learn after they have gone across. They were very successful with this work, and they wrote a book called 30 Years Among the Dead. It's out of print now, so far as I know, but it was a fascinating account of the many cases in which these spirits were driven out by static and then were turned over to the good spirits to be policed up and to be educated and cared for and taken to their proper realms. An experiment was tried here a few years ago to try to duplicate the work, but since Dr. Wickland was gone, television and radio has come in, and they were unable, even with an iron room, to keep the static from going out and interfering with all of the television and radio within the, quite a distance of the iron box. Also, they had difficulty to find just the right medium. So that method was given up. Sometimes obsessing spirits, such as the one that was attached to Adolf Hitler in the old days, can cause a great deal of trouble. Hitler's obsessing spirit was evil. The reading for him shows that he was obsessed. It shows that he was obsessed by an evil spirit and one that had a very powerful will and was far more intelligent than Hitler himself. This spirit urged him on, gave him his hunches, and used Hitler in such a way that he was able to upset the whole balance of power in Europe and almost upset the world balance. It took world in arms to put down that spirit, you might say. So it would be a very excellent thing to be able to spot Mr. Spirit when he is powerful and intelligent and is in charge of some political figure, some figure that could cause world trouble. Someday we will have our groups working so that the parole boards, the people who release prisoners after they seem to have been reformed, can have a psychometric analysis made of each prisoner when he says, "I am reformed, now I will be a good man if you will just put me out on parole." You can tell very quickly whether there is a counterclockwise circle still there or not in the reading. And if there is, you can be quite sure that the man has not reformed and that as soon as he is out, he will begin to do again the same type. He will rob a bank or whatever is if necessary. I may have mentioned this parole board business before, but it is very important, and it is to be hoped that one of these days when we get the fellowship going right, that we will be able to move in this field and begin to serve. For a moment, I wish to go on to the matter of using the pendulum. I said that we would talk about that very little, but we'd expect the people who are working with it to have my little book and to take their instruction from that. I want to give this idea. In my book, you lay the tape out in front of you, and you have a chart at your right. You swing the pendulum over the chart, and you move the signature or the thumb of the person who is being read along the tape. You move it farther and farther and farther away from the chart. And sometimes the signature is moved so far out on the tape that the one who's swinging the pendulum can't reach that far, and he has to have somebody else move the signature or the photograph or the thumb farther away for him. I suggest to you that you get on the other side of the tape and reverse the procedure. Put the signature right at the edge of the zero mark on the tape. That will be where it comes under the chart. And then yourself go down the tape with the pendulum. Let the pendulum swing freely and keep moving it farther and farther away. It will be swinging at a diagonal as you go along until finally you come to exactly the right degree for that person, for that reading. Say it's the degree of 345. As you come to that point, moving slowly along with the pendulum swinging, the low self will give you the signal by starting to swing the pendulum horizontally instead of diagonally. If you go too far away past that point, it will swing the diagonal in the other direction, and you will have to come back until it swings exactly in the middle. This little bit of instruction may be played again two or three times on the tapes to the people who have the natural ability and who are learning to make the psychometric analysis. It will help with the matter of the length of the tape and the distance that it has to be have the signature moved along it. I think you may all be interested, if you have started to form classes and have enough of you joined up to be HUNA fellows, and who know that we are planning to develop our healing circles, to hear a report that has come in from the second group of the Portland group. The Portland group was the garden group, and it had been established for quite a while, but one of the leaders of this group took the tapes and started in inviting friends that mostly had never heard of HUNA. And they started from scratch, you might say, a new class, a new group to do a little missionary work and spread the knowledge of HUNA. Another letter earlier, she told about the work that had been done healing the burned hands of a girl named Sally who had scalded her hands. And they made their circle, accumulated their vital force, made their prayer, and in a very short time, with the girl's hands immersed in warm water, and with a candle lighted, which was their custom of healing before they took the Huna method of accumulating vital force, they had healed the hands in short order so that the blisters were all gone, the redness and the soreness and the pain was all gone. This young woman, whose name is Sally, was unfortunate enough shortly after that to be using a jackknife. I don't know what she was doing with it, but it slipped and drove the blade about 4 inches into her knee. She had to go to the doctor and have several stitches taken, and the knee was very, very sore and very lame. It, for a little while, seemed to partly paralyze the leg. The girl had been walking on the crutches. And when this new class was coming together, getting ready to hear a tape, the letter I will read here, I asked the group if they wanted to try a circle method of treatment, as we had our favorite subject here, and again we put Sandy, the girl with the leg, in the center, this time with her foot in a bucket of water, a warm water. Also, we lighted the candle. We all joined hands, palms up, by touching thumbs, palms up, touching thumbs. Then we accumulated our mana, and I suppose they made their prayer. Her leg was very definitely moving at this time in the water, and she said that she felt as if she was very strongly pulled in my direction. Again, the water felt like heavy oil, like it had done at the time that her burns were cured. When we were through, she did not use her cane, and earlier I had felt a lump the size of a dime where the cut had been, but now I felt again, and it was not there, not there at all. She is doing just fine and told me that she would drop you a line and tell you all the details. I am very much pleased with the way some of the classes are starting out. Leadership, of course, is a very important thing, and some of the leaders have experience. Others have to go at it as very new and do the best they can, but it is always encouraging to hear that the healing has been tried. We can do marvelous things with the group at the circle and the healing. If you wish to use water to immerse, this was a bad knee, but the foot went into the warm water. The water seems to accumulate the vital force and put it there for the high self to use for the healing. The candle, which was lighted, the rest of the light, I think, were subdued in the room. But the candle was lighted as the symbol of the high self, the light. And that is a physical stimulus. It makes the low self think of this symbol and think of the high self, and is a very good thing. Candles have been used in religious services for a very, very long time. At first, the sun was the symbol of the light, and then at night, when there was no sun, the artificial light, the little lamp, and especially the candles were used. They became ritualistic, of course, in the churches. In this same group, the new group is being helped to get acquainted with the low self by using the pendulum to see what is in a small box. The way this game, the box game, which is described in my second book, is played. You find four match boxes. The little safety matches are good. The main thing is that the boxes must all look exactly alike. Four or six, or I used to use five. You empty the matches out to get the empty boxes, or if you can get pill boxes that look just alike, those can be used. The description in the letter I have of this is The first thing we did was to play a little with the pendulum and have the four small boxes all alike, and we put a penny into one of them and then mixed the boxes all together and then used our pendulum to tell us which one had the penny in it. This is good practice and good exercise to start with. So by the time we get to your lecture on this subject, they will have some acquaintance with the idea of the low self. In our original group, we used medals and so on. They had these little Holy Spirit medals of peace that I have spoken of before. Then we played the first game called Boys and Girls. This is a very interesting thing, and I must explain that our groups are not set. We are continuing to experiment to find out what can be done by groups. Heretofore, the group work has been badly neglected, and the experimental work has been carried on by individuals or pairs very largely. Here we are working with a group, and in this group, which is working so beautifully up in Portland, they have a friend, a Dr. Binkley, who has been working with them for some time with a combination of his own ideas and of some of Borrowed. And he discovered that it was a very common fault with people that they couldn't make their imagination work. That sounds odd, but it seems to be that some people have a difficulty in imagining a thing quickly and clearly, and that they get mixed up so that the reality mixes in with the imaginary. So he made some little games, and the game that they used and they found was very interesting was one in which the leader of the group would give commands. I have here a carbon copy of the game, and I'll show you how the game goes. The leader says, "The name of this game is Boys and Girls. Now let us imagine that there is a boy standing in the corner of this room." And everyone is given time then to imagine a boy standing in the corner of the room. When everybody has that imagination, I suppose they raise a hand if they haven't, or make some signal. Said, "Let us give him a hat. What color would you like that hat to be? Let us give him a jacket. What color would you like it? Let us give him some trousers. What color do you want the trousers to be? Let us give him some shoes. What color are they?" You see there, they are imagining and picturing as a preparation to be able to imagine the perfect condition that they're going to ask for in prayer. And by limbering up the imagination and being able to make a visual picture, you might say this is visualization. Now, what color is his hat? What color did you change it to? Change it again. What color is it this time? I suppose different members answered to those questions. Change it again. What color? Look at the jacket. What color is that? Then the questions go on later on. Have the boy lie down and roll across the floor. Have him run around on his hands and knees. Have him stand on his hands. Have him sing Yankee Doodle while he is standing on his hands. Have him run around the room on his hands. You see, they are having to visualize these things in this game, one thing after another. Then they introduce a girl. Put the girl in the corner. Give her a red hat. Give her a blue sweater. Give her a green skirt. Give her brown shoes. Have her be in another corner of the room. Have her in still another corner. Have her sing London Bridge is Falling Down. These questions go on for two or three pages, and then later on they have a game which is called the Animals Game. And with that we read, "We are going to start with one little mouse and see what we can do with it. Let's imagine that there is a little blue mouse somewhere in the room. Where would you like to put him? All right, have him sit up and wave at you. Have him turn green. Have him change color again. Change it again. Have him stand on his hands. have him run over to the wall, have him run up the wall. Then later on, put a little dog right over there pointing at the place, have him bark, have him sit up and laugh, give him a name, George. And these things go on, and the people respond. The leader of the group who is using those games says that these games that Dr. Brinker has given us permission to use, and happily, are of great value because they show if there are mental blocks that are keeping people from making clear visual pictures and realizing that there's a difference between imagination and reality, and to separate these. It's a powerful separative action that comes about through the practice. If some of you would like to make little games like that and try them, I would enjoy hearing a report and to know what you did. I will have later reports from the Portland group on how the animal games come out, what they accomplish with them, and what those games do in the matter of helping to visualize the prayer picture, the thing that we wish to have when we are making a picture of what we want and what we are seeing as already given us here and now. Incidentally, in the letter, it was reported that some of the beginners with the boys and girls game gave instances of in which they had trouble changing the picture that they had made mentally. One place, the girl and the boy were put together on the roof, and then the leader said, now bring them down off of the roof. And one person couldn't get them off of the roof until they had imagined a slide and let the children slide down from the roof. So it shows there is a mixture between the reality and the imagination that needs to be considered in handling these things. In another recent report on an early group meeting, this was Mrs. Jack Becker down at the tip of Long Island from New York, and she had read the, had listened to the tapes herself a number of times, familiarized herself with them, and gathered a group. She was anxious to get a group of younger people, students, and whether they were students or just it was a mixed group of some sort that she had. And she reported that they were all enthusiastic over the first lecture that told what HUNA was and how the code had been discovered, but that after the second lecture, when they found that they had to do something, then they made all kinds of excuses, and only one or two or three, I take it, out of a group of several, turned up for the following lectures. In our work, we'll have the winnowing out process going on all the time. We will have the people who are invited to come in who are not ready for the work, who are anxious perhaps to be given a magic word, to be given a prayer, or to have something of a more materialistic nature. The people who can grasp HUNA and can understand it are not too common. They have to be of a rather high mental caliber and level of intelligence, and to have a very good innate goodness. The people who are evil, when you speak of living the hurtless life, do not respond. They wish to continue to hurt people and do not cotton to the idea of becoming hurtless. And now I see my time is running out. So hold the faith, stand close to the light, and my aloha.